This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The expression increased levels of chatter often accompanies a warning that a terrorist attack may be imminent. We learned that chatter had increased just before September 11th. My guest, Patrick Radden-Keefe, has written a new book called Chatter, which he describes as his attempt to figure out how chatter works, who can listen in, and how they go about it. As Keefe is quick to point out, he's not an investigative journalist, detective, or spy. He describes himself as an average curious citizen. He's a third-year student at Yale Law School and has written for the New York Review of Books and Slate. In some ways, his book is really about his adventures trying to understand programs that are shrouded in secrecy, like the NSA, the National Security Agency, and Britain's GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters. Keefe's interest in chatter dates back to the late 90s when he heard of a global surveillance network called Echelon. Back then, he didn't know whether this network really existed or if it was just part of a conspiracy theory. I asked him if he now thinks it exists.
I do. I mean, in fact, ironically enough, once I'd finished my book, a former head of the National Security Agency came out and acknowledged that the network exists and acknowledged the name Echelon. I mean, Echelon started out as a code name. It specifically referred to a particular computer program for sorting through all of the communications that were intercepted via satellite. And we use Echelon as sort of a watchword to refer to the network as a whole. But the funny thing about code names is the minute you reveal a code name, the code name is obsolete. So we have now had a former head of the NSA come out and say, yes, there was this system. It was called Echelon. It's a sure bet that nobody's calling it Echelon anymore, but the system is still there.
So what kind of information does the system collect?
Billions and billions of phone calls and emails, primarily, and faxes and telexes. And the ones certainly over satellite, these communications are the interception is sort of broadband. I mean, rather than try and isolate up front a particular phone call that you would want to intercept, you would instead intercept all of the phone calls that were going over a particular satellite network.
So when we hear that there's a lot of chatter and that means there's likely to be an imminent terrorist attack, do you think it's likely that this network was doing a lot of the listening to that chatter?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the way when you hear a story in the press that refers to chatter, the way that chatter is gathered generally is through this network that the United States runs with its four principal allies, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand.
So were you able to talk to any of the actual, you know, decoding or interpreting experts who do the listening in?
I talked to a number of people who had done that. No one who's doing it currently. There's a real prohibition within these agencies against talking to the press or to anyone, even in some cases to your own wife, something the NSA refers to as the security state of mind. There's an old joke that the old saw is that NSA stands for never say anything or no such agency. And I found that that made it exceedingly difficult for me to find people who currently are doing this kind of work to talk to me. But I did talk to a handful of people who have done it in the past, in some cases the recent past, and they described for me the job of putting on headphones and listening in.
Why don't you describe it for us?
Well, there are different positions that one has in terms of assessing these communications that come in. There are translators and there are analysts, and then there are cryptanalysts whose job is to decode any coded communications. And I talked to people who had done all three, and it was interesting because the experience they described was sort of at once kind of intimate and yet unfamiliar. So if your job is to listen in on a particular set of people, say in the Chinese government, you sit at your desk, and at your desk often you have photographs of these people because it helps if you can match a face to a voice and a name, and they become sort of characters, and you keep track of them. And so there's this tremendous familiarity. At the same time, there's obviously a great distance and a great gulf between you and them. First of all, they by and large don't know you're listening to them. Second, if you work for these agencies, as a rule, you're not allowed to visit the countries that you're studying. So it's a kind of a paradox in a way.
it's easier to comprehend the job of listening in on a select group of people. Much more difficult to comprehend what it's like to sort through all of the, quote, chatter out there, you know. So can you give us a sense? Do you know? Was this something you were able to learn, like how information is sorted from that chatter? I mean, like you point out that every 3 hours, the NSA satellites pick up enough information to fill the Library of Congress. That's every 3 hours. So this is an extraordinary amount of information. Now, not all of that information is chatter, obviously, but, you know, what are some of the techniques for sorting through the chatter?
Well, they've tried to automate it as much as possible. One thing you realize is that it's much, much easier whenever you have anything written. It might be text in an email that you can sort very quickly through. It might even just be that there's a phone number or a name that you're targeting. But that makes it much easier to sort of pre-select the types of people or conversations you're looking for. The stories you often hear are that if you say bomb on the telephone, the NSA or the FBI will come after you. That's certainly not true with the telephone because it's very hard for these technologies to spot a word in spoken speech. But it's very easy for them to spot a word in written language. I mean, it's the same principle that you have at work in something like Google. You can sort very rapidly through billions and billions of pages of text in order to find the particular keywords or concepts that you're looking for. But what this means with telephone calls is that a lot of the time those might have to then be transcribed in order to make it easier to sort through. Or if you have the particular phone numbers of people you're interested in, then you can focus in just on those. But even that doesn't seem to be working. I mean, we heard last year that the FBI is still sitting on hundreds of hours of intercepted conversations between Al-Qaeda suspects that no one has translated. So those aren't just hundreds of hours of intercepted phone calls that happen to be in Arabic. Those are between Al-Qaeda suspects, and no one has actually sorted through them and translated them and analyzed them.
You did get to see a listening base in England's Yorkshire Moors. And although it's in England, it's run by the NSA, the National Security Agency. So are you assuming that this is part of the Echelon network?
Yes. I mean, in fact, there have been documents that have been declassified or been found through the Freedom of Information Act, which suggest that this was one of the primary bases in this network. And it's a pretty extraordinary place. In the middle of the English countryside, this sort of micro community of 1,200 Americans who are eavesdroppers who work around the clock intercepting satellite communications.
We should say this base won the NSA's Station of the Year Prize in 1991 for its role in the Gulf War. You describe this as a 24-hour operation. There are people work, I think, 8-hour shifts, but there are always people working and listening in and decoding information. Just describe what it looks like.
It's a really arresting sight because it's in this sort of placid agrarian environment. These green hills and crumbling stone walls and cows everywhere. And you come up over a hill and you see, I mean, it looks like a space station or something. There are these huge white domes, which are called radomes. They look like golf balls, basically, but they're enormous. And each one houses a satellite dish in it, and the satellite dishes are pointing up at these communication satellites in space. And there are 24 of these domes sort of almost seeming to float there in the countryside. And the whole area is fenced in with a sort of razor wire fence. It's a 500-acre site. So it's a strange kind of enclosed, very space-aged base, but in the middle of countryside that otherwise probably hasn't changed in 1,000 years.
Is there a reason it's in the countryside?
I think there are two answers to that. One is that there's always a reason for locating a satellite interception base where you do, and it tends to be in terms of where there are downlinks for commercial communication satellites. So it would be in the place where it is so that it can conveniently pick up downlinked satellite traffic. But the other explanation for the remote location is that a lot of these listening stations I found all over the planet are in very remote locales. They're hidden away. They're designed to be unobtrusive.
Okay, now you've got this kind of hidden in plain sight operation. You've got this highly secret operation that isn't enclosed. You can't exactly hide that. So what's the official explanation for the base that's given to the public?
There isn't really an official explanation. I mean, it's a very funny thing, actually, over the years, the different explanations that they give. It even starts with the name. If you go up to the gates, the front gates of Menwith Hill, it says RAF Menwith Hill. RAF stands for Royal Air Force. So the suggestion is that this is, in fact, a British base, despite the fact that inside it's primarily Americans, and the British Air Force has nothing to do with it. There's no place to land planes. There aren't large contingents of enlisted British Air Force people running around.
How deep into the base did you get?
The front gate. I didn't get inside. I didn't really expect to, but I was able to walk around the perimeter fence and sort of observe a great deal from outside, and then, again, forced in a way to use some ingenuity because they wouldn't let me in, I went to a pub over the hill in a local village and talked for an evening with people, with British people who live in the village around, about their impressions of the base. And a number of them had worked inside the base, in cafeterias and what have you. And so they were able to tell me a bit about what goes on inside.
Did they actually know what the purpose of the station was?
Well, they did. I mean, they knew that it was for the interception of communications. They joked. These were, in some cases, teenagers, and one of them joked with me that it was an alien testing base. So they knew, in I guess, broad brush strokes, what went on inside. What was interesting, though, was that they said that inside the working areas and the living areas are very strictly segregated, and much of the work goes on in these underground basements. They worked in the cafeterias and the recreation centers and what have you. So they weren't actually able to get inside the control rooms where, you know, these billions of communications are being pumped in and analyzed.
One of the things you looked into in doing your book is how the development of cell phones, the creation of cell phones, has affected the ability to listen in on people, the ability for the NSA and other spying agencies to listen in. What are some of the things you learned about that?
Well, one thing I noticed is that in terms of the old war, which was the war against the Soviets, and the new war, the war on terrorism, the old war was very static in every way. You had a static enemy that was, you know, roughly in the same place, and the faces didn't change all that much, and you knew where they were, and they were using landlines a lot of the time. The new enemy is very dynamic. Al-Qaeda is present in as many as 60 countries around the world, and they use cell phones and satellite phones. These are, on the one hand, very easy to intercept. I mean, the mechanics of intercepting a cell phone or a satellite phone are pretty simple. They're using microwave signals. You know, the word wiretap originally referred to tapping copper cables, but the minute something hits the air, it becomes easier to intercept. The problem is that if your adversary is using cell phones, they might be using disposable cell phones. They might use numerous cell phones. One of the people I talked to was a Pentagon official who told me that there was a strike on an Al-Qaeda figure caught in Yemen, and when they found him, he had more than half a dozen cell phones on his person. So he would just use them and then discard them. And if he used each one once, he figured it would be very difficult for Allied intelligence to get a bead on that number.
So it's easy for the people we're spying on to evade the spying with cell phones.
Absolutely. And email as well.
So you learned some things about how Osama bin Laden himself changed his use of cell phones when he realized how his phones were being listened in on.
Yes, this is one of the great cautionary tales, I think, for people writing about this kind of intelligence. In 1998, there was a story in a Washington newspaper that said that the United States was able to listen in to Osama bin Laden's satellite phone. And the day the story came out, bin Laden stopped using that phone. This was interesting. I mean, it meant that he was clearly keeping up with what we are and are not able to do. And I think it also had a chilling effect on journalists in particular who write about this area, because the sense was it's very, very easy to compromise operations if you talk about this sort of thing.
Well, I've often wondered, you know, since everybody knows now that we were listening to the chatter or monitoring the chatter, you'd think that maybe the terrorists who are being monitored would stop using their cell phones or would maybe, quote, chatter a lot to mislead us. Any insights into whether there's a lot of chatter disinformation?
Well, I think they do both. I mean, it's interesting. I think they both have learned, in some cases, the hard way to stay off the air when they're talking about something serious or planning an operation. We know that Osama bin Laden often, at this point, sends messages via courier, an almost Luddite reaction to our ability to listen in. We also know that they do send out red herrings and disinformation. In a way, it's more in keeping with the classical definition of terrorism, where the amount of terror generated is disproportionate to the actual casualties. If our adversaries know that by putting a certain message out on a certain channel, they can raise the level of terror in the United States, and municipalities will around the country will be on the ready for an attack, they could bankrupt us that way. It's an effective technique.
Now that you know a little bit more about spying capacity and eavesdropping, are you any more paranoid than you used to be?
Yeah, you might ask. Certainly, initially, I became very paranoid because in the early part of my research, a lot of what I was aiming to do was just find out how transparent communications are, how easy it would be if somebody wanted to, for them to read my email or listen to my phone calls. And the answer I discovered in fairly short order was very easy. And that initially freaked me out a little bit. But it's interesting because I sort of pushed through that and I realized that just because they can doesn't mean they would. I am certainly troubled by the fact that everything is so transparent. But in a way, I came to the more alarming realization that our intelligence agencies are really struggling. They're in an uphill battle to keep track of all of the information that's being gathered just on terrorists. The notion that they would spend any time keeping tabs on me would be paranoid, certainly, but also maybe a trifle narcissistic. And it's funny, I mean, it was something that I saw in the many people I talked to, many of whom are quite paranoid. I mean, for instance, I interviewed at great length a young woman who had been a translator for GCHQ and left because she'd leaked an important memo to the press. And she told me at a certain point that she was convinced that all of her communications were being listened to. And I sort of thought, boy, if I knew what she knew, wouldn't I be paranoid too? I mean, there was an inclination to write her off as being paranoid, but then again, she'd been inside. She knew what these agencies were capable of.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Patrick Radden Keefe is the author of the new book, Chatter.